American humorist Mark Twain once asserted that the difference between lightning and a lightning bug is like the difference between the right word and the almost right word. I was reminded of the truth of that quip just a few weeks ago as I was browsing in one of my favorite bookstores. It struck me then and there that it is bad enough that all of the academic mollycoddles that somehow survived the Woodstock generation are trying to run our universities and our media outlets and our federal bureaucracy, but now they're trying to wreck our libraries as well, and our dictionaries. It seems that the fuzzy-minded one-worlders and the bleeding-heart eco-geeks and the perestroika pipsqueaks in the New York publishing clique have unveiled their grandest exercise yet in politically correct collectivist twaddle. It is the new edition of the Webster's College Dictionary. Apparently these Orwellian cranks, in an effort to somehow properly indoctrinate the wider proletariat, have spiced up their dictionary with all sorts of nifty new words that properly reflect the grand aspirations of their new world disorder. Here are a few of my favorites. Humankind, that is the collective human race, according to the definition. Or women, spelled W-O-M-Y-N, to avoid any chauvinistic implications, don't you know? That's a group of female adults. Then there is her story, H-E-R-S-T-O-R-Y. That's the study of women's affairs throughout, let's not say history, but... And then there is weightism. That's a bias against fat people. And heightism. That's discrimination against short people. Now, as someone who doesn't happen to be short, and in fact is somewhat over the average of the typical American, I can tell you that I haven't seen much heightism around, especially on airplanes. I can't even get a tray table down. But at any rate, it's in the dictionary. My favorite one, though, of these new words is waitron. That is a person of indeterminate sex who waits on tables in a restaurant. Now, I don't know about you, but I've seen this person. I don't want to go to that restaurant again. Now, again, I don't know about you, but I'd expect this kind of roomy-eyed, bolshy blustering in the Whole Earth Catalog or Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream Annual Report or in Bill Clinton's State of the Scalawag Address. But in Webster's Dictionary? Give me a break. Dictionaries certainly should reflect changes in language. But these words are not words that are in daily use. Rather, they are simply the inventions of a few Philistine ninnies bent on changing the way we think. As the Honorable Jefferson Davis asserted so long ago, attacks on great cultures come first through the denigration of language. Now be assured that these mean-spirited logogogues are not merely setting their designs on vandalizing our language, spraying their pseudo-pluralistic graffiti upon our thoughts. What they really want to do is lay siege to the whole of our civilization. Thus, their cultural attack has come at us from all sides. It seems that the Clinton-hammered, pedophobic, anti-Semitic, tyrannosexual, and super-fatal existential trocious radicals from the Save the Starving Third World Lesbian Codependent Wales crowd is ready to dispatch all the gains of the Western world with nary a qualm. So their brutalitarian metamorphosis of our language is only the first of their long line of attacks. And compared to the rest of their anthropophobic agenda, their telepathetic logomorphing ranks as little more than just a measly part-time McJob. As a result, we are presently afflicted by what social critic Kenneth Myers calls a plague of terminal trendiness, of course, across the whole span of our society. And it's working. We seem to have bought this homodox bibble babble lock, stock, and barrel. Even in our churches, our thinking has been squeezed into the mold of the politically correct network TV worldview with amazing alacrity. And so we tone down our denunciations of sin, lest we be accused of being judgmental. We minimize doctrinal distinctives, lest we be accused of being divisive. We blur the boundaries between virtue and vice, lest we be accused of being legalistic. We brush off heresy, lest we be accused of being intolerant. And we veil our concerns about social disarray, lest we be accused of being somehow too political. Thus, recovery seems to have replaced repentance. Dysfunction seems to have replaced sin. Drama seems to have replaced dogma. Positive thinking seems to have replaced passionate preaching. Encounter groups seem to have replaced evangelistic teams. The don't worry, be happy jingle seems to have replaced the prepare to meet thy God refrain. The 12 steps have replaced the one way. In the church today, it is far better to be witty than to be weighty. We want sensitivity and soft sell. We want acceptance and tolerance. We want upbeat, low-key, clever, motivational, friendly, informal, yuppified, and most important of all, abbreviated truth. No ranting, no raving, no Bible thumping, no heavy commitments, no strings attached. No muss, no fuss, no hassle. We want the same salvation as in the old-time religion, but with half the substance and a third less guilt. And if that is true in the church, it is sadly all the more true in the culture at large. A concerned citizen, protective father, and a compulsive crusader that I am, I decided early on in my career that a studied defense of the unvarnished truth was in order in this day of thick varnishing of everything. I determined that it was essential to stand against the rising tide of this multidimensional and cross-disciplinary academia. Of course, there's a heavy price to pay for those who have the audacity and the temerity to violate the hallowed standards of political correctness these days. Mel Bradford discovered that. He addressed the subject that I'm supposed to address tonight. And he suffered the consequences throughout his distinguished career. Joe Sobrin has tasted that bitter wrath, as have Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard and Otto Scott and Andrew Nelson Lytle and a whole host of others who have faced similar fates. I say all of this, and I have this huge lead-in to this short topic for one reason. By standing here in this place and giving this address on this particular topic, my career is now over. If I ever had any political aspirations, one look at this video on television just does me in. I might as well have a white pointy hat. By giving this address at this place in this time, and not because anyone within the matrix of the LibNet will actually take time enough to evaluate what it is that I have said, just by doing it, I have eliminated myself from the possibility of fitting into the mainstream world. I do that quite gladly. Actually, I've been out of the mainstream for a very long time. The only reason I begin this address in this fashion is to illustrate how far we have gone. We can't even discuss certain things without being condemned for it. I received a call day before yesterday from a very prominent national leader who somehow stumbled across a brochure advertising this conference. He said, "George, have you gone crazy? What are you doing?" He was serious. And he said, "Well, George, I don't want to get into it. Don't confuse me with the facts," in a sense. Which, of course, has never been a barrier for him in the past, but Steve knows who it is, so he's well, the eulogy for my once promising career now done. What about Lincoln and Lenin? How is it that I have come to identify this very unlikely pair as the makers of modernity? The contrast between these two men, Lincoln and Lenin, are obvious enough, I think, to anyone. Lincoln was an American. Lenin wasn't. Lincoln was a Republican. Lenin wasn't. Lincoln was duly elected and constitutionally inaugurated as the chief executive of his nation, while Lenin had to write his own constitution following an irregular, if not revolutionary, takeover of his national government. Lincoln submitted to many, if not all, of the strictures and structures of politics in his day, of American politics, whereas Lenin remade Russian politics according to his own image. Lincoln was already dead some 5 years before Lenin was born. These facts we know, and the contrasts are quite obvious, and there are many other contrasts. But the comparisons between the two men are even more striking, I believe, than the contrast. Both endured unhappy childhoods of tragic loss, economic deprivation, and moral scandal. They both lived lives of rootlessness in their families. Though essentially self-educated and demonstrating some remarkable promise in law early on, both men suffered a long string of failures, sorrows, and humiliations. Although Lincoln apparently had a change of heart just prior to his death, both men were bitter opponents of Christianity, writing scurrilous tracts, professing untempered ridicule and unreserved scorn for the faith of our fathers. Both were instrumental in the establishment of new political parties that attained quick success despite almost insurmountable odds. Both men were popularly known as liberators, emancipators, champions of their peoples. Though in both cases, their words and deeds actually belied their reputations. Both men were lifelong loners with few, if any, intimate friends. Both endured unhappy marriages of odd political convenience. Both men were physically unimpressive and indeed rather homely. A fact that, though, actually helped rather than hindered them in their respective careers. Hardly orators, both were unorthodox public speakers who nevertheless had a profound gift of storytelling and immediacy that enabled them to, in combination with high-sounding sloganeering, to utterly captivate their audiences. Though neither ever had the support of more than 10% of the citizenry of their respective nations, they ruled over those nations, and they were both amazingly gifted as politicians, able to forge motley coalitions of disparate radicals, ideologues, and bureaucratic functionaries into some semblance of an operative governing consensus. Of course, both men waged furious civil wars. In each case, a struggle between an industrial North and an agrarian South, each lasting 4 long and destructive years. Each of these men oversaw a catastrophic conflict that would ultimately rend the entire social fabric of their respective lands, that pitted father against son and brother against brother, that visited the twin scourges of plague and famine upon literally millions of their own countrymen, that ravaged the productive capacities of vast, vast realms of once rich and fertile lands, and that snuffed out hundreds of thousands of lives. They both utilized foreign revolutionaries, either veterans or the progeny of veterans, from the Marxist insurgencies of 1848 in Central and Western Europe to bolster their positions. And both enthusiastically unleashed a whole host of experimental, new destructive technologies that would forever change the face of warfare in the world. Both men believed that they were fighting a righteous cause, that by forcibly denying men and nations self-determination and self-rule, they were actually promoting a greater good. Thus, both men sanctioned the suspension of civil liberties time after time. Both men imprisoned thousands upon thousands of political opponents, and both sanctioned the use of terror and rapine on the battlefield and off. At the end of their lives, both men were forced by the catastrophic turns of events of their time to actually question everything that they had stood for, to call into question their entire political careers. In fact, gripped by broken-hearted despair at what they had wrought, both men attempted to somehow temper or ameliorate the devastation and destruction they had unleashed in the post-war period, only to be overruled by more radical factions. Both men were struck down by assassins' bullets, and both consequently died. Lincoln almost immediately, but Lenin actually lived for another 3 years. But because of complications, particularly in the clotting of his blood, he was stricken with a stroke time after time after time and ultimately died. Both men laid the material and political foundations for what would shortly become the world's two greatest military powers. And so at their death, were bitterly mourned by their nations. Both men became martyrs, in a sense, to their respective causes. Both became icons of the movements that they launched. In their two respective countries over the next 100 years, it would not be possible to go to any town, to any village, to any public building without seeing at least an image or a reference to one or the other of them. Both, of course, became for their nations, or rather the amalgamated unions that their successful wars of annexation created, heroes, unquestioned heroes. In fact, to question their heroic status became the only heresy worth prosecuting in modern days. Lenin was born in 1870 in humble circumstances of a frontier town, Sibrimsk, on the Volga River. His father died when he was 13. His brother was executed 3 years later for his part in a plot against the government. So the young Lenin lived under the twin pall of poverty and of shame. Things in his life only went from bad to worse. He was expelled from school. He did poorly at business. He had a rather undistinguished career as a junior law clerk. Before he plunged into the life of law and politics, biographer Bertram Wolfe notes that he was an unmitigated failure at everything that he tried. And he tried almost everything. Lincoln was likewise born in rough and humble circumstances in rural Kentucky. His mother died when he was 8. And his father, a migratory farm worker and craftsman, was in and out of trouble, moral and legal, all his life. Thus, Lincoln, too, bore the weight of poverty and shame. He, too, failed in a number of ventures before he finally found success in law and politics, but even had a rather shaky start in those two as well. Every one of his activities leading up to his success as President of the United States was, as Carl Sandburg said, a distinct and profound failure. In fact, Sandburg says his life was composed of one calamity after another. Lenin was out of the country when the Romanov imperial dynasty came to an end in Russia in March 1917. His friend grew up together in childhood days back on the Volga. Alexander Kerensky eventually emerged as the new democratic leader of the vast Russian land. But Lenin was astute enough to recognize that the fragmented nation, torn by conflict and threatening to come apart at the seams, was very vulnerable at that moment. And so he rushed home to his land, and he began to engineer a series of surprising electoral victories in the northern industrial strongholds of St. Petersburg and Moscow. And by November of that year, he had gained effective control of the federal government, although most of the rest of the nation was resoundingly rejecting his Marxist comrades at the polls. When it appeared that he would be able to maintain his political supremacy at the seat of government, warrants were put out for his arrest and his cohorts. But he quickly, masterfully effected a coup d'etat and grasped the reins of federal power in Russia. Though the people of Russia were astonished at this, the peoples of the indigenous nations around Russia were even more astonished. And so very quickly after Lenin had seized power, there were a series of declarations of independence and secession proclaimed by the various southern states of Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Belarus, Poland, Czech Bohemia, Slovakia, Armenia, Uzbekistan, and others. In addition, the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Finland also seceded in short order. Lenin and his trusted comrade Trotsky quickly formed their infamous secret police and Red Army in an attempt somehow forcibly hold the Union together. It would not be an easy task. The new Southern Confederacy and their White Russian Army possessed both the sympathies of the world and the best and the brightest and the bravest military men that the land had ever produced. Mikhail Rodzindako, Antonin Denikin, Georgievich Kornilov, and Mikhail Alexeev. Nevertheless, Lenin and Trotsky wielded their superior industrial base as a weapon of aggressive fury, launched an invasion of the Southern Confederacy, purportedly to free the enslaved Cossack and Kulak proletarian masses there, who interestingly desired not to be freed. At first, the war went rather badly for the Reds. The whites, despite their limited resources and supplies, had the moral advantage. The whites were fighting for God, for family, for their own homeland, for independence. Had the English or the Americans, who were closely monitoring the conflict and who favored the whites, had they lent the Confederacy any sort of material support, their cause would have undoubtedly succeeded. But they remained reticent. The Americans, because President Wilson was afraid of getting entangled in another foreign war. And the English, because Prime Minister Lloyd George was convinced that the Bolshevik cause could not possibly prevail. He said, "It is an ideology of insanity. They cannot rule. And therefore, we need not fear that they will inflict their pain and sorrow and suffering upon this century." No prophet, Lloyd George. After fighting an appalling war of attrition, in which food and water were weapons no less powerful than cannons and bayonets, Lenin finally prevailed. The Union, the Soviet Union, was saved. Again, the parallels with Lincoln are more than just a little striking. Webb Garrison, in his remarkable book, The Lincoln No One Knows, describes the many paradoxes of the man, his unremitting separatism, if not outright racism toward blacks, his reticence to end slavery even after the political ploy of the Emancipation Proclamation, which of course affected no guarantees of emancipation whatsoever, his abrogation of innumerable constitutional standards and guarantees, his absolute refusal to a negotiated peace settlement, all of these were paradoxes in Lincoln's life. But the most beguiling enigma of this complex man of genius, according to Garrison, was his commitment to enforced union at all costs. It was actually, according to Garrison, a kind of innovation in the affairs of men and nations, the fruit of a fairly new philosophy called nationalism. Lincoln was its first great exponent. Lenin, its last. Nationalism is not a philosophy, much less a word that we understand terribly well in these modern times. But in fact, the real connection between Lincoln and Lenin are summed up in this single philosophy. All of these other comparisons that I have given you pale in comparison to this comparison. It was their nationalism that was the most important parallel between the two men. As E.J. Hobsbawm has pointed out in his masterful monograph entitled Nations and Nationalism, nationalism is indeed the wedding of two philosophies. It is the philosophy that says, he says, that the nation is the same as the government of that nation, and that it is not possible to understand the nation or its culture apart from its organizational apparatus. So nationalism begins, Hobsbawm says, with the notion of statism. But it goes beyond that because, as Hobson says, nationalism has a paradox at its root, and that is that nationalism is never content with a single nation. So nationalism is always international in its scope. Think of all the great nationalists of the 20th century, or those that we have called nationalists. They have always been imperialists. They've always gone adventuring to conquer new lands for their great nation. Whether it is a Reich or a Soviet Union, or if it is something as minor as a manifest destiny to spread from one coast to the next. Even the vocabulary of nationalism, according to Hobsbawm, is a very recent vintage. This is a new idea, an innovation in the affairs of men. It was not until well into the 18th and 19th centuries that the institutional phrases that we take so for granted today, like state or polity or federal government or even nation, came into common usage. As short a time ago as the founding of the American Republic, political discourse preferred to speak of the Commonwealth, the people, the confederation, the common land, the public, the community, or cooperative welfare, in order to avoid the centralizing and unitary implications of nationalism's nationhood. The New English Dictionary underscored that distinction in 1908 when it stated that the old meaning of nationality envisaged little more than an ethnic unit, but that a wholly new meaning had begun to emerge that stressed the notion of political unity. At virtually no time in the past, prior to Lincoln and Lenin, did men identify themselves in terms of a political entity or nation state. Instead, they saw themselves as members of a culture, of a family or a community, or even more likely, of a common bond of faith, a covenant people. Jurisdictions and boundaries were set according to those relational and covenantal loyalties rather than by government edicts. Thus, patriotism was interpersonal. It was not institutional. Men did not see themselves as citizens of Spain or of Italy or of France. Their identity was not defined by a temporal state, but by an eternal estate among men and peoples. Their sense of purpose was rooted in who they were rather than where they were from or what they did. And so locales were not nearly as important as the shared values that predominated in those locales. The men of the South understood that. They understood that they were heirs of a tradition called Christendom, and that what made them distinctive was not that they lived below a certain surveyor's mark across the map of the United States, but that they held certain truths to be eternal truths. They saw themselves first and foremost as members of a united Christendom, which explains their strong ties to Old England. That was a kingdom that was actually above other kingdoms. They were thus no less the vassals of Christ's earthly empire, Republic, than they were the vassals of local overlords, monarchs, and hierarchs. That's why the map of Europe prior to Lincoln and Lenin is so mind-bogglingly indecipherable to us. It portrays not just a forgotten geography, it portrays a forgotten philosophy. Until then, there was no such thing as Spain. Spain is a modern invention of 14 different kingdoms from European Christendom. There was no such thing as Italy. That did not come about until the late 19th century. There was no such thing as Germany. Germany has not existed except in the minds of a few politicians through the years. Austria, Hungary, Yugoslavia. Each of these seemingly eternal unions are actually modern constructs of a philosophy called nationalism. Nationalism is not pride in nation. Nationalism is not a sense of a single nation. Rather, it is a philosophy that weds the notion of statism with imperialism or expansionism. It is a political alchemy, altogether innovative in the affairs of men and nations, and one that recent turns of events seems to have repudiated. When we turn on the network news and we hear about the resurgent nationalism of Central Europe in Bosnia or in Croatia, what we are witnessing is not nationalism, but the unraveling of nationalism, the repudiation of nationalism. Fall of the Soviet Union is the greatest testimony to that unraveling in our time. By seeing their respective nations in terms of politics, in terms of state power, and in terms of forcible union rather than in terms of culture or of voluntary ethnic or interpersonal relations, Lincoln and Lenin were prototypes of the New World Order. That is what links them, not their wars, not their attitudes towards servile status within their realms. It is not their powerful ability to sway crowds. Rather, it is their commitment to a single philosophy, the philosophy of the 20th century, the philosophy that transforms every discussion into a discussion of politics. Whether that discussion is family values or health care, whether that discussion is whether or not we can actually barbecue hamburgers in the backyard, or whether or not we can protest against the slaughter of the unborn in our cities. The state has subsumed all things under its banner. Founding fathers of the American Republic actually feared the notions of a subsuming of all concerns under the rubric of ongoing political passions. And thus they tried to construct a system that actually minimized the impact of parties and activists and political ploys. Citizens of the Republic were expected to turn out at the polls to vote for men of good character and broad vision, and then pretty much forget about politics until the next election. Governor Morris, who wrote the first draft of the second federal constitution, was instrumental in its acceptance. He said, "The Constitution is not an instrument for government to restrain the people. It is an instrument for the people to restrain the government, lest it come to dominate our lives and our interests and everything in our lives and our interests." The Constitution is the greatest repudiation of the Clinton administration ever devised. Patrick Henry stated, "Liberty necessitates the diminutization of political ambition and concern. Liberty necessitates concentration on other matters than mere civil government." That's what liberty takes. Suspicious of political, of professional politicians and unfettered lobbyists, as well as the inevitable corruptions of courtly patronage and special interests, the Founding Fathers established a system of severe checks and balances designed to depoliticize the arena of statecraft and its attendant statesmanship. Lincoln and Lenin stood four square against that notion, which is why Lincoln had to attack the South and dismantle it, and Lenin had to attack his South and dismantle it. Russian nation, the Russian nation of Lenin's day, was a remnant of medievalism prior to the advent of modernity. It was an interconnectional and interpersonal nation in its construction. Politics remained at the periphery of daily life and was in fact rather despised by those charged with the duty of running the affairs of state. The whites, prior to their defeat by the Reds, upheld this ancient tradition with dignity and grace. Thus, their communism or their republicanism, their attitudes towards serfs or slaves, their atheism or conversionism, their tactics in war or in peace, all these are but incidental in comparing and contrasting Lincoln and Lenin. It is their pioneer work in forging the ideology of the 20th century industrial nationalism that highlights these two undeniably brilliant men as the makers of the 20th century, the makers of modernity. Ironically, the nations that they made from their nationalism were also the harbingers of the new internationalism of which we are tasting the wrath even now. Hilaire Belloc pointed this out in his book, The Servile State. He said that it is natural, though paradoxical, a consequence of all politically centered societies that they should expand beyond their competence and destroy ours. So Russian scholar Bruce Lincoln, ironically, wrote at the conclusion of his massive trilogy on the Bolshevik Revolution, "The overarching ideology of modern times is not either capitalism or Marxism. It is not democracy or communism, Western thought or Eastern thought. It is a kind of supra-political nationalism." Lincoln and Lenin, this seemingly odd couple, are in fact joined at the hip by those strong bonds. And if we are to properly understand and deal with the forces that swirl about us in these dire days, then we must discern from whence they came and to where they will go. The dustbin of history. Thank you.